Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for joining us today and welcome back. In a previous show on Guide to the Cosmos, conservation biologist Dr. Rhys Halter told us that we are destroying our economy and poisoning our planet by relying on 19th century technology to generate energy. Today we will explore CleanR, a new and exciting approach to green energy, energy that is dramatically more abundant, cheaper, and less polluting. Joining us today to discuss CleanR and what CleanR is and can achieve is Lewis Larson, President and CEO of Lattice Energy. Hi, Lewis. Welcome to our show.
Hi, Robert.
It's great to have you today. Before we start talking about CleanR, let me give our listeners some background on nuclear energy. The nuclear energy that we are most familiar with is nuclear fission, and this is a process in which large nuclei, like uranium, are broken down into smaller nuclei and release about 100,000 times as much energy as a typical chemical reaction, such as burning coal or burning petroleum. The good news is it's 100,000 times more efficient. The bad news, of course, is that fission generates a lot of radioactive waste, and no one's stepping forward to have that buried in their backyard. Completely different from nuclear fission is another process called nuclear fusion, and this indeed is what powers the stars. This is nature's way of making energy. This is a process by which small nuclei, like hydrogen, are fused together to make larger atoms like helium, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, iron, and in fact, all the atoms that living things require. To find a way to master nuclear fusion here on Earth to generate the energy we need is the holy grail of energy production. What makes fusion so difficult is that all nuclei have a positive electrical charge, and like charges repel each other. So all these positive nuclei want to push each other apart instead of coming together as we'd like them to in the process of fusion. And up to this point, the only way that people have thought that they could get nuclei to come together was by heating the material to extremely high temperatures, comparable to the center of a star, and then the particles would have enough energy that they would be able to overcome this electrostatic repulsion and fuse. Efforts to achieve nuclear fusion on Earth have been ongoing for about half a century, and they have made some very modest progress, but all of these efforts have been focused on very high temperature reactions, such as exist in the center of a star. A few efforts have been made to study the possibility of doing fusion at lower temperatures. These are often called cold fusion. But up to this point, there hasn't been a comprehensive theory of how this could possibly work that made any sense to scientists. The results weren't reproducible because of that in part, and so cold fusion has largely been rejected by the scientific community. Now things have changed. Now, Lou Larson and his company have a new idea, a very different and creative idea, and this is called CleanR. The notion is to produce low-energy neutrons, and since neutrons don't have an electric charge, they aren't repelled by nuclei, and so these low-energy neutrons can be absorbed by the nuclei and result in energy release. A recent NASA investigation led by Dr. Joseph Svodny gave a very favorable evaluation of the Wyndham-Larson theory and said that this theory will be applicable to both aerospace applications and also to terrestrial power generation. And here to explain how that works to us and what might be achievable with that technology is Lou Larson. Lou is a physicist, entrepreneur, and the CEO of Lattice Energy in Chicago. He has an AB degree in biology from the University of Chicago and did his graduate work in theoretical physics at the University of Miami. Lou also has an MBA from the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business and 30 years of experience in technology-driven businesses. Lou, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Tell me, Lou, how exactly are we going to be able to make energy with Kleenar?
It's a question of time, effort, and money. There has been about 20 years of effort, mostly in experimental work, much of which came under the rubric of what you would refer to as cold fusion. There were numerous, I guess you would call them experimental anomalies. There was heat, they saw some nuclear products, but nobody could really make sense out of these things on a theoretical basis. The effect of that was to make it very difficult to understand how to do better experiments. And so the field was held back. What we have done in our contribution to the field has been, starting in 2005, we began publishing in journals a theory of these reactions. But it wasn't fusion. It's something different than fusion. I won't go into the technical gore, but it's called weak interactions. And all you really need to know is that it's not fission and it's not fusion. What it does do that is unique in comparison of both of those other types of nuclear processes is it's clean. There's no hard radiation. That means there are no energetic neutrons. There are no energetic gammas. And you don't make long-lived radioactive isotopes. And mind you, up until now, the data was there, and a lot of the experiments produced good data, but nobody could understand it. So what we have done is, as Robert has said, is we have developed a theory, and it's based on known physics, just physics that exists today, but put together in a different way. Where our theory diverges from what you typically see in nuclear physics or plasma physics or the hot fusion work that Robert was alluding to is the fact that it typically involves only a small number of particles, typically two or three. That's what happens in stars. In the core of a star, when you get fusion reactions, there's just two or at most three bodies that interact together to fuse and create nuclear reactions. In these systems, which, like an electrolytic cell, which is not unlike a battery, are what are called condensed matter systems. That just means it's not a plasma, it's not hot, it's solid stuff. And in these systems, something different happens. You get what are called collective effects. Now, what does that mean? That just means that there are many particles interacting at once. And what this opens up the possibility of doing is that harnessing these collective effects to do things that ordinarily would require extremely high temperatures and or pressures, like in a star. So when the initial results of some of these experiments were published, they saw all these new elements. In fact, when they did the detailed analytical work and looked at these things, after 2 or 3 weeks of this electrolysis in this fashion, it looked like the elements came out of a star. And that was what was so hard to understand, because clearly in this little beaker of water and a little bit of electricity and a couple of an anode and a cathode, you clearly didn't have star-like conditions. Yet you had results in terms of what is called nucleosynthesis, which means you're making new elements that look like it came out of a star. So what our theory does is it puts together collective effects with existing physics. And by the way, too, collective effects is not a new thing. It's an old thing. People were talking about this back in the 1920s. They just didn't use it very much. And when you put together those types of things in the physics, you can make sense out of all this. And as now that we have a sensible understanding of what created all this anomalous data, that opens the door to actually doing engineering, which means that you start to focus experiments on more reproducible production of heat and products and getting a technology that can create usable heat reproducibly, which is what you do either in a coal-fired power plant, where you boil water, or in a nuclear plant, many of which you also boil water. So the end result is to make heat. And what you want to do is to do it by the cleanest, most energy-dense way you can do it. And this fits the bill.
Okay, Lou, so the advance that you've really made here is to combine a collective effect with the weak interaction. And by using the collective effect, you essentially are taking small amounts of energy from many different particles, and so it's effectively a low-temperature reaction, and combining those small amounts of energy to create a low-energy neutron through the weak interaction process. And this is in stark contrast to the other approaches in which all of that energy had to come from one particle, and that was achievable only at very high energies. So this ability to do the collective effect allows you to have a process which does not generate these radioactive waste products that everybody is so concerned about with nuclear fission.
You're exactly right. What is unique about this is the way it's done. And nature has been doing it this way for a very long time. And what it allows you to do is to make clean heat. Now, when you have these, as you point out, you do make neutrons with this process, but they're not energetic. Think of them as very large, fat neutrons. In fact, some of them are about the size of a bacterium or a virus. And what that means is that they're all absorbed right there. So you make these nuclear reactions. Now, the next thing that happens, and this gets a little bit into the physics, is, but you have these kind of heavy electrons that are involved in making neutrons. These electrons are unique because in these little regions, let's say on these metallic surfaces, it makes like a gamma shield. And the gamma radiation that you would normally expect from these kinds of neutron absorption reactions are converted locally into infrared. So you absorb them locally. You make new elements, they decay, and the gammas are shielded and converted to infrared. So you have built-in gamma shielding. And the other thing that happens when you're absorbing low-energy neutrons, you tend to make what are called neutron-rich isotopes. That just means they've got a lot of neutrons on them. When you turn the current off, these things are very unstable. They decay very quickly through what's called a beta decay, which is really just an energetic electron, which you can stop with a piece of paper. So you don't get any hard radiation out of these things, and you don't get long-lived isotopes. So it's a truly clean, green nuclear technology.
Mm-hmm. And when you say that the neutron is as large as a bacteria, you're referring in the quantum mechanical sense to its wavelength.
Yes, exactly.
To a physicist, that's a measure of size, but to other people, they might wonder how could you make a neutron as big as a bacteria, but that's how. It's a question of its wavelength.
It's a question. You have the wavelength and straight quantum, ordinary quantum mechanics.
And the lower the energy, according to quantum mechanics, the longer the wavelength.
So exactly.
These are very low energy neutrons, and so they appear to have a very large wavelength, a very large spread, and so they can't get through a condensed matter system where there are lots of atoms in a small area. Now, Lou, you said another interesting thing about CleanR, and that is that we could actually use this process to get rid of some of this nuclear waste that comes from the other process called nuclear fission. Now, how would that work?
Absolutely true. What it is when you talk about the product of nuclear fission, right now, outside of these reactors scattered around the United States, in what are called cooling ponds, they are storing all these waste. And some of them are pretty hot, and they're full of a lot of really nasty, some short-lived, some long-lived radioactive isotopes. But the problem with these wastes is that some of these isotopes are active for thousands of years. And right now, since Yucca Mountain has been put on hold, nobody, as Robert said, wants this stuff in their backyard. What are we going to do with all these things? They can't be allowed to accumulate indefinitely. Well, one of the applications for this is take this nuclear waste, grind it up, inject it into a special reactor that's in a building next to the regular reactor where you store all these wastes, and use these ultra-low momentum, these very big neutrons, which are absorbed on this waste, to transform it into stable isotopes. And it's really a very straightforward process that can be done at reasonable cost once the technology is fully developed. So we do have a method for cleaning up this waste. It doesn't stop the generation of waste because you're doing the same fission process in the reactor, but it at least gives us a reasonable technological approach to clean it up and get rid of it so it's not there for future generations.
So you could make an addition to existing nuclear fission reactors that would convert the waste that they produce into stable isotopes. Could you really make enough neutrons to convert all that mass into a stable isotope?
Yes, you can.
Wow. And that process would probably release a lot of energy because, after all, that's why these nuclei are unstable and radioactive, because they have more energy than the ground state of a stable nucleus.
Absolutely. It's a great fuel.
So we might actually get energy out of the process of cleaning up all that waste.
You certainly could, and you could pump that energy right back into the electricity grid.
There's nothing better than to take garbage and turn it into gold. You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and today we are talking about green energy from Cleanar with Lou Larson. We'll be right back after this message.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, GuideToTheCosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's GuideToTheCosmos.com.
We're back again talking about green energy from Cleanar with Lou Larson. Okay, Lou, let's talk next about how we could use Cleanar to get more energy from petroleum. Now, you told me that there are a lot of deposits of heavy oil around the world, oil that's hard to extract, and Cleanar is a process that could help us extract more of that oil from these deposits. How does that work?
The way it works is currently up in, let's say, for example, Canada, you have about what I think the estimates are something like 1.7 trillion barrels of this heavy oil. They call it bitumen. It looks sort of like the asphalt you see on roads where it's mixed in with the gravel. It's very thick, viscous stuff, and when you drill down to it, if you have an underground facility, you can't pump it. It's too viscous to pump. It won't come through the pipes. So what you have to do to get it out of the ground is to heat it up. Well, presently, up in Canada, where they're doing it the underground route, which is about 80% of the deposits, they are burning natural gas to make steam, pump the steam down in the ground to heat this heavy bitumen up so they can pump it up and out of the ground. So you're adding carbon to the atmosphere when you burn the natural gas, and then you're also adding carbon to the atmosphere when you ultimately use the fuel. So what we could do that would help this out is to create cleaner heaters that you would put down the drill holes. They would go down there, generate an awful lot of heat, nuclear heat, in fact, heat it up even hotter than they can get it with steam, and it would tremendously enhance the recovery, and you also eliminate the carbon footprint from burning natural gas to heat up the oil.
Well, that sounds great. How far off do you think a technology like that might be?
With sufficient capital and the right set of partners around the world, 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're still going to need oil in 10 years, so maybe that's something we ought to get started on.
I agree. This could enhance the oil industry. Many people people might think that this competes. It does at some level, maybe in the long term, but in the shorter term, it could make the recovery of heavy oil much less expensive than it is today, mm-hmm. which helps everybody at the gas pump.
Absolutely, and we all need that. So, Lou, you also told me that in some of these heavy oil deposits, there are substances that you could use directly as a fuel for your cleaner process. How does that work?
How that works is really based on some new results that have come out of a researcher in Japan, a fellow by the name of Dr. Tadahiko Mizuno at Hokkaido University. What he has done is he has shown how you can trigger cleaners, it appears, in aromatic hydrocarbon. And that's a fancy word for saying benzene, which most of you have smelled benzene. It's got an aromatic, it's a pleasant smell. And what he has shown is that you can trigger cleaners on these things. Now, this has to be validated by other researchers, but if it is, and it in fact is the case, what that means is that we could take aromatic hydrocarbons, which in the case of the heavy oil bitumen deposits up in Canada are anywhere between 10 and 30%, and burn them as nuclear fuel. So instead of doing the normal processing on that, you would separate it out, put it into a special reactor. Instead of burning it and releasing chemical energy, you release nuclear energy, so it's worth millions of times more as a nuclear fuel than as a chemical fuel.
Mm-hmm. So this nuclear fusion process is millions of times more efficient than, for instance, burning petroleum.
Oh, very much so.
So if we wanted to get a certain amount of energy, we'd only need to burn 1/1,000th as much petroleum if we could use a nuclear process as we would need if we use the standard chemical combustion processes.
That's correct. And although this is somewhat more speculative because his results have not been widely duplicated yet, he's had good results in the past and has been a reliable researcher. And the other interesting thing about this, if it, technologically we can do this at some point in the future, burn these aromatics, is right now they're a waste product.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not good to have in, for example, diesel fuel because it lowers what's called the cetane rating, which is like the octane rating in gas. And if we can do this, because we know now, because of our theory, how to capture these very low-energy neutrons on these carbon atoms in the rings,
mm-hmm.
you can stop at nitrogen. You can stop at iron. You can take this process and release a lot of energy, and you aren't releasing carbon in the atmosphere.
So you're converting the carbon into nitrogen or oxygen or silicon or even all the way up to iron.
Yes.
And in the and every step of the way releases energy.
Exactly. So right. We release all this nuclear energy. Now, I want to point out for the listeners that there's no free lunch here. All we're using the neutrons for is a match to light the fuel. The energy was put in these nuclei that were, quote, burning when they were made in stars billions of years ago. So we're just taking fuel from the stars and igniting and releasing the binding energy with neutrons.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Lou, you also said that these cleanar reactions are not something new and out of the blue, but rather that these reactions are actually seen in the cosmos, in natural processes, in stars, and in other cosmic bodies. So tell us a little bit about that.
They are. What we did with our theory, what we've talked about here is the way our theory as it applies, which is really the collective effects plus electroweak phenomena, in what, as we said before, condensed matter, which is solid stuff that you find around you. It turns out that when you get to much longer what are called length scales, in other words, bigger systems where you have these organized magnetic fields, like on the surface of a star, you know, people have seen pictures of the surface of the sun, and you have these beautiful flux tubes coming up in arcs and going back down. It turns out that this collective approach also applies there. So, for example, when you look at it that way, it looks sort of like a step-up transformer, which are used on your utility poles all over the place. Step-up, step-down transformers. And that's very familiar, and that technology has been around for 150 years. What we have here is we have energy that is transferred collectively from one group of particles to another group of particles through a magnetic field. Now let's take the sun. For the last 60 years or so, there's been an anomaly in that the corona, which is well up above the surface of the sun, is hotter than the surface of the sun itself. The surface of the sun is something like around 6,000 degrees centigrade. The corona is in the millions. Well, it shouldn't be hotter, it should be cooler. So there's a mystery there as to why the corona is so much hotter than the surface. It turns out that using this theory, there's a very easy natural explanation for why the corona is hotter, because you have all these particles down below, just below the surface of the sun, you have much less dense corona, the energy is communicated through the magnetic fields, and you see them outlined in the flux tube, transferred to the smaller number of particles, and because you have a smaller number of particles, you transfer this energy to them, they're going to be hotter. So the corona is hotter. It turns out that this type of process, which is mediated by these organized magnetic fields, these ropes and stuff you see on the surfaces of stars, like the sun, you can do nucleosynthesis. So up until this point, the assumption was the only nucleosynthesis going on was deep in the core of stars, where you had all these what you would call charge-particle fusion reactions, because everything is the plasma down there. What this theory allows one to see is that, A, you can explain the mechanism for heating of the corona. B, we can see from our theory that the protons react with the electrons to make neutrons, which can trigger nucleosynthesis in the photosphere, out through the photosphere, and all the way out through the corona. Now, what's interesting about this is that there are anomalies that astronomers have noticed spectroscopically on other stars. There's this one very strange star. It's called Strzelbielski star. It's a real mouthful to pronounce. But it's a very odd star, and what the astronomers notice, and there's some controversy in astrophysics about this, but a Strzelbielski star has short-lived radioactive isotopes in its atmosphere. Now, they're short-lived, so you can't dredge them up fast enough from the interior of the star to get them there, so they had to be formed there. So what this means is that you've got this mechanism doing nucleosynthesis out in the atmospheres of stars. You can go one step further. Around these stars and stellar nurseries, you have all these young stars. They're putting all this ultraviolet radiation, and they're typically surrounded by these dense dust clouds that are laced with hydrogen. Well, it turns out that under these conditions, on these dust grains, which are very tiny, you can heat them up. If you've got hydrogen, if you've got some metals, if you have some of these aromatics, carbon molecules, you can create nucleosynthesis in dust clouds. Generally, it was thought that all the nucleosynthesis since the Big Bang, since our universe was created, occurred in the core of stars. And in supernovae, which are basically cores of stars that are exploding. If this is correct, and there's more must be established to ascertain that that's in fact true, but if our theory is correct, it means that there's nucleosynthesis taking place in the atmospheres of stars and in these dust clouds, which in a broad sense means that nucleosynthesis is a very broad phenomena in the universe. And that's something that people just didn't think about before.
That's amazing. And the name of the theory that explains all of these processes, the collective effects and the combination of the electroweak interaction, Widom-Larson theory.
Yeah.
Okay, so people can look that up on the internet. And you can also look up on my website a link to get back to Lou Larson's presentations that in which he explains this theory in a great more detail, and also explains the applications that this technology can bring to bear in more detail as well. Well, since we know we can't continue to burn petroleum and coal because we can't afford it and because we're destroying our environment by doing so, and since it's well established that nuclear fusion is probably 10 million times more efficient than burning coal, it only makes sense that we do everything that we possibly can to learn how to make energy the way nature makes energy, through the process of nuclear fusion, which powers all of the stars. Remember, you can go to my website, guidetothecosmos.com, for a link to Lou Larson's website at Lattice Energy. Lou, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Robert. I enjoyed our chat.
And join us again next week when we explore how to make the world's largest telescope with our guest, radio astronomer, Dr. Jonathan Romney. Thank you for tuning in, and remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.